Welcome back, one and all. Welcome back, myself, to Soft Revolution, the podcast. We're really, really happy you're here. I'm Torquil Campbell.
I'm Ali Moman.
And I've been
welcome
away.
Welcome back, my friend.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. I've driven across this beautiful country. I'm back in Vancouver. And the shitstorm
What have
continues.
You learned? What have you learned? Because I had this image. I'm like, oh, this is great. You know, Torquil's in the car. He's looking out into the sunset.
I'll
He's
tell you, I've learned Canada's... Thoughts. I've learned that Canada's very, very empty and that we have plenty of room for lots more people and that it's very beautiful. But most profoundly, I guess that, you know, you're always reminded that this is not a country where you can drive from town to town, take a couple hours and play a show or go see a show or whatever. You're driving 12 hours through wilderness before you get to the next place where anybody lives. And so it brought home to me how, you know, difficult it's going to be for us all to survive. Today on the show, speaking of which, we have Dave O'Brien, who is an English academic and thinker and writer who's written a really cool new book called Culture is Bad for You. Very provocative title, possibly not exactly what he believes, but... as he said, you can't get people to read academic texts, so you got to give it a sexy title. But he's a fascinating guy, and we have a chat about what he's found through his research and study about the cultural scene in England and what the $1.7 billion that the British government has committed to saving cultural institutions might mean for them, but also for individuals in the UK. So, Ali, what's going on with you? We were just talking before we went on air. You've been sort of looking into the future and talking to people.
Futurist.
So you've gone futurist. What are you hearing from people who you've been working with?
People who I'm working with, but also what I'm reading in the news. For instance, you know, our friend Andrew Lloyd Webber, he is really pushing forward for his like Seoul model, the South Korea model, in which he's doing Phantom of the Opera there, and he's trying to create a system for it to continue in England. So he did this like test concert in which he had like 250 people. He hired a singer, a famous singer, to come out there.
Yes,
yeah, and he's like totally analyzing it. In Germany, they're doing they call it like the 19 test, and in which literally rather than actually let's just see where the shit is, let's actually create it in a lab safely and actually find some data. It's very German. So they've actually 1,000 people have volunteered to go see a concert by a very famous soprano. And what they're going to do is the scientists are there, everyone's in a mask, and then everything is going to be measured. The viral load, the transmission is going to be measured so that they can get an idea. Then they're going to go to 2,000. And I'm also hearing from people whom I've worked with and are working with, it is no longer like there is going to be an event called V+1. I used to call it Vaccine Day +1. That is no longer the case. We have to figure out how we are going to do this. And we could talk about whether or not that is possible going forward. But the reason we bring this up is the thing we were talking about before is our head doctor, our Fauci, Theresa Tam, she was saying that this shit show can be with us for 2 to 3 years, masks and social distancing.
Yeah, I was really shocked that she would get up in public and say that. And I understand that doctors don't always have the best bedside manner and that she's speaking medically. And so, you know, she's giving all the possibilities and trying to be realistic. But it led me to pause in thinking whether or not, you know, we started this podcast. I remember the first conversation we had on this podcast was about bringing hope and compassion and imagination into the discussion around this disease. That when public health officials got up, they had to speak human to human. They couldn't speak medical officer to human. And I think Bonnie Henry in British Columbia has done a tremendous job of that, of talking about kindness and consideration and always using the phrase, not forever, but for now. So for Theresa Tam, who's the chief medical officer of Canada, to get up and say apropos of kind of nothing, well, we could be doing this for 3 years, even if there is a vaccine. I just don't get it. I don't get why that's a good thing to do. I don't get why that helps anybody. I don't get why it saves lives or helps people be more healthy. It made me want to give up. And if you read the comments under articles about what she said, it made thousands of other people want to give up. And I just don't get what the messaging around this is and why she felt it was important to say to people, this could be terrible. It could also not be terrible. So I that really struck me as a bad decision on her part.
Well, I read this article by Ed Young in The Atlantic. He is like the guy to read about this pandemic. And he was actually talking about how, you know, again, we're speaking about this vaccine, but we need to realize that the efficacy of the vaccine is probably going to be in the 50 to 60%, just like a flu vaccine, especially the first round. Secondly, we're dealing with a situation in which I could speak for America because they've done a polling. I don't know if they've done any polling in Canada or the UK or wherever, but over like 50% of people are saying that they may not want to take the vaccine when it comes because it's happened so quickly and whatever. And then it's the distribution of the vaccine. So I think, you know, the more science, you know, has a feature and a bug. And that is, you know, when new information comes, we just say it. But I think what you're saying is you need to have consideration for the messaging and how you say it and the effects of it. You know, I think there is definitely a possibility or a great possibility that what she's saying is actually based on all the information that she has in front of her. This is a novel virus. So they're learning new things about it all the time. And I think that's the case. Now, definitely there's no kindness. Definitely there's no compassion. That's some shitty ass fucking bedside manners to say, yeah, it's going to be 2 to 3 years. Oh, well. I think, however, there is a possibility that it could maybe spark some imagination in us and it could maybe give us a kick in the butt.
Kind of, like, isn't that her job too? I mean, I don't know how you say to people, well, this could go on for 2 to 3 years without a caveat of saying, and we are aware that this will completely destroy the following major industries, tourism, the arts, you know, like, come
restaurants.
On. Restaurants, like what hotels?
Restaurants are more screwed than we are. You can't eat with a mask on.
What is going, like, why? I just don't understand why they feel that they can continue these policies without any kind of acknowledgement of where that leaves a huge chunk of the working population. It's like, you know, not everybody works in the oil and gas industry or is a public school teacher. People do other things. And there just seems to be this, like, they're in a state of denial about having to face it or something.
Like, that's why I really appreciate Germany. Germany is like, you know what? We are going to figure out, maybe there are ways that we can, through science, technology, and what's called NPI, non-pharmaceutical intervention, we can try to figure out a way to do certain things as opposed to just giving up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, giving up's not an option, obviously. And they did do a show in London in the rock and roll world. There's a great article in Vice. But again, quite depressing. Frank Turner, who's a folk singer and rock and roll singer in England, very popular, did a show, a socially distanced show in a 2,000-seater or 1,500-seater for 250 people. And they took a survey afterwards about how people felt about the show and whether or not they enjoyed it. And the overwhelming response was no. The audience were told not to sing along. They were told not to yell. They could clap, but that was it. And, you know, it's like, of course, that's not the option. You know, art is about self-expression. It's about freedom and it's about emotion. And if we are asking people to not express themselves and to have no emotions, or to at least, you know, kill those emotions while they're in the show, what's the purpose of art anyway? Like, what are we actually doing? And Frank Turner actually said that afterwards. He's like, it just made me feel like, is this what I wanted to do with my life? But am I just going to sit around and moan and say how sad it is that I can't do it anymore? I have to try and be part of the solution. But the solution doesn't seem to be very apparent. It really, really doesn't.
Well, are there going to be cultural winners through this? Or do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, do you think of yourself and you say, okay, how can I win here? You know, there's always winners and losers. Obviously, we know the big corporations. Amazon is killing it. Apple's killing it. Facebook's killing it. But in terms of the culture sector?
Sadly, I think, you know, we're going to talk to Dave about this later. And he mentions that he feels that, yeah, there might be winners, but those winners will be big companies. that, you know, even on the scale of not-for-profit cultural institutions, the ones who will be saved are the ones that reflect most closely a kind of anodyne general impression of what culture means, i.e. the ballet, the opera, you know, the National Theater, Stratford, whatever, those kind of things that people have heard of who don't actually go to cultural events. Those will be the things that are saved.
That's in his book too. Part of the inequality is that, you know, the what is considered culture really is a minority. You know, the things that you were referencing to, that people actually don't, the majority don't access it.
Yeah.
So the, yeah.
Yeah. But we'll see. You know, I'm about to experience in a month's time my first foray into some kind of solution. Stars have just announced that we are playing a live show at a drive-in to 200 cars. We had long, complicated conversations about whether this was worth doing, whether we thought it was a good idea. I'll tell you that the margins are tiny. You know, everybody's taking a lot less money than they're used to, including the promoters, and certainly we are. And the audience is paying more than it's used to.
Right.
So we'll see. The hunger is there. You know, people are seem happy that we're doing it, and I'm very appreciative to the promoters who are just doing this really out of the love of art. You know, I mean, it's not going to make them any money. But that's not a future. You know, that's not a possibility. And as I talk to people in the music industry more and more, I do sense a really overwhelming amount of denial, of just pure and utter denial, you know?
Tell me what that looks like. Tell me what that sounds like.
Well, it looks like people still holding on to shows that they think will happen at Christmas. It looks like people rescheduling tours to next spring. It's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen unless some miracle occurs. Now, a miracle might occur. The disease might die out. The vaccine might be incredibly effective and they might be good at distributing it. All these things might happen, but you can't plan on might. And even if they do happen, I think, how do you psychologically get people back into the theater? So I think, you know,
Actually, that's the big thing, because I keep telling, everyone mentions in the theater world for where I have, you know, my foot in, they're talking about, you know, the Seoul Korea, the South Korea model. But I have to remind them that yes, 800 plus people go to see Phantom of the Opera every single night in South Korea. That's the one major theatrical tour that's going down. But the culture there is very different in the sense that when 800 people go, they're all wearing masks, they're sprayed, there's huge contact tracing. But when, heaven forbid, they go home and they get a notification that a performance of Phantom of the Opera may have exposed you to the virus, they don't freak out. They go, they get their test, they make sure that they're okay. Heaven forbid they have the virus. The country has set up hotels that they go and they isolate for 14 days. They have it set up. They have the system set up.
Yeah.
Whereas here, you know what's going to happen. Come from away comes back. There's like whatever, somebody or a star. Heaven forbid a real live stars, like a real live stars show happens and one person gets COVID and all of a sudden everyone gets a notification and the thing comes out where, you know, oh, if you were at this concert, you might have COVID. It's going to be on every fucking news broadcast.
Yeah.
We're going to panic. We don't have that culture. So maybe there is a way, and perhaps this goes to what you're talking about, Theresa Tam. Maybe there's a way that our leaders need to be able to articulate and speak in a way to take us to the South Korean model. They're going to watch the baseball games over there, man.
It's incredible. It feels surreal that there are parts of the world now where life is basically returned to normal and the rest of us are still figuring out whether or not we have to disinfect our groceries. And, you know, I've had a tough week. I'll be honest with you. I've had a week of feeling pretty hopeless. And pretty scared. And I keep going in search of reasons to be hopeful. The only one that I can find is that I think the instinct for storytelling and the instinct for song and the instinct to reflect our world in a way that we think is beautiful is a deeply human one. And it won't leave us, even if the possibility of making a living doing those things does. But that doesn't, you know, for those of us who've earned a living off of that for 20 years or 25, that's not a big comfort. And,
I'm feeling envy
towards
and I whom? Labeled it and I labeled it because I would feel these like feelings, you know, envy towards people who have jobs I never wanted, envy towards the lawyer, envy towards the regular quote unquote person. I have like this like constant thinking in my brain that like my whole life was a mistake. Why did I make those shitty choices?
Right.
Why did I choose to whatever? And then my therapist was kind enough to say, she's like, you know, you made the right choices. What you did was right. You got to a place where you were able to both do what you love and make a good living doing it. So those were the right choices. So I got to remind myself all the time that, look, I made the right choices before. I have to have faith that I'm going to keep on making those right choices. So yeah, but yeah, envy. Like I'm like, what the fuck? Why do I want, why am I envious of like this regular guy working in an office?
Yeah.
What the fuck? Yeah. What's happened to me? I never wanted to be that guy.
I think you feel envy because his life has not changed as much as yours and his future is not as uncertain as yours. And also I think that there is like a giant psychological toll if you're a practitioner of art to not making it for a long period of time. It starts to feel really bad inside yourself. And
it atrophies, you know, the muscle gets weak.
The muscle gets weak and the whole impulse starts to become the signal that your brain sends you that tells you, get out there and do this. I think that there's a certain amount of panic that when I get back on that stage, will I actually be able to do my job? You know, will I look out at 200 cars and think to myself, I don't know what the hell to do here. I don't know how to play this show. I don't know how to play to a Mazda Miata. You know what I mean? Like it's a hell of a lot of unknowns, man, and a hell of a lot of scary, scary things. And I hope there's some good news soon.
Everyone's trying to figure it out. I mean, even Disney yesterday announced, you know, they announced their quarterly results and they lost $5 billion. And one of the things they're doing is like, they're releasing Mulan. I don't know if your daughter is going to be into this, but you could buy Mulan for one day for $30.
My daughter is a musical theater just junkie. So unless it's got a good tune in it, she's out.
Who's that girl?
Barbara Streisand is all that she cares about in life. Until Barbara Streisand puts out a new film, Ellington is not interested. But I mean, I don't know who's going to pay for that. And I don't know what any of this means, man. And I think it's funny, you know, I haven't done this podcast in a couple of weeks and I've been listening to you doing a great job with our guest hosts. So I've been listening to the show as a listener and I'm glad it exists because I think it's a forum to discuss a lot of the things that are on all of our minds right now. But I do return to this podcast feeling like my energy to fight right now is being sapped and I'm worried about getting my kid back in school. I'm worried about the CERB fund running out. I'm worried about, whether or not I'll ever play a show again. I've got to drive back across Canada again in 3 weeks to try and record with my band and then drive back again. All these kind of crazy things. And I know so many people are in so much more hot water than myself. And I guess that the only thing that sort of I can find some comfort in is the knowledge that we are not alone in this. We're all together in this situation and we're not going anywhere and we're going to continue to try and figure this out together. And things change and they will continue to change. And so, you know, 3 months from now or 4 months from now, we may know a lot more about what our future looks like. And even if that means that our future is grim and hard, at least we'll know. And that takes me back to what the Teresa Tam thing is like, listen, Teresa, all respect due, but if you don't know anything, don't say anything. I don't need your suppositions or your guesses or your predictions. I really, really don't, because they're predicated on hard, cold facts. And hard, cold facts are hard and cold. We all know what the facts are. So unless you have some spiritual advice, I kind of need you to not talk for a while. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a tough one. It's a tough one. So all that to say, we're going to talk to Dave O'Brien, who's been working on this kind of cultural policy with our friend of the pod, Jennifer Lina. Shout out to Jennifer Lina. Go buy her book and Dave's. They're available online to read and they help you through, I think, talking to logical people who've done research about this stuff is helpful because they are actually giving you information that you might be able to find an idea in the middle of. So let's get to the interview. Should we do that? Is there any more we need to, is there any more we need to cover this week? Everything sucks. We're all frightened. Hang in there. Yeah. And
hang
we love
in there.
You.
And everyone's figuring it out. And that stupid Quibi is like dying.
And next time I hear from Teresa Tam, I want her to get up behind that microphone and be like, dudes, it's going to be all right. That's all I want to hear.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. Dave O'Brien speaking to us on Soft Revolution.
Dr. David O'Brien, all the way from where are we talking to you right now?
So I'm actually in London, in sort of North London right now. But I work at the University of Edinburgh because Britain is much smaller than Canada. So it's like easier to do the commute.
It is indeed. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. You're here to talk to us about a book which I've just started, but which is already fascinating to me because of the number of big issues that it brings up. And it's called, very provocatively, Culture is Bad for You. Dave O'Brien, stand behind that insane statement. Why is culture bad for us?
Yeah. I mean, now obviously the pandemic and the kind of devastation across the arts and cultural sectors, as well as, you know, other parts of economy and society, the three of us are maybe a bit like, was that too provocative? But you know, we
can never
have known
be
that.
Too. Yeah, in the age of Donald Trump, I think it's impossible to be too provocative. You just have to out provoke everyone else in order to get anybody to listen to you.
No, this is true. This is very true. I guess. What we were going for was, I mean, it's similar in Canada, in the States, in Australia, in bits of Europe, like France, the Netherlands, Germany, that there's this kind of assumption that culture is really good for us. There's a lot of research on like health and well-being, on like urban regeneration, on the relationship between kind of cultural engagement and exam results or community cohesion, bringing, you know, different parts of society together. And we wanted to say, whilst, you know, there's really good research on that and we accept that, actually nobody pays attention to, or at least many people in those kind of spaces don't pay attention to the relationship between culture and inequality. And that's culture and inequality in terms of like who consumes culture, which is marked by inequality, and also who gets to produce or like work in culture, who gets to be an artist, a filmmaker, a writer. That's also marked by inequality as well.
And one of those things that you mentioned early on in the book about this idea is that it's not just about who gets to make it and who consumes it, but what it is and who gets to define what it is, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, We draw on kind of various bits of sort of sociological theory on this, but on a fundamental level, if we think about, say, the process of like commissioning a television show or signing a music artist to a record label, giving a grant out for a, you know, a poetry competition or something like that, or deciding to financially back a theatre production. All of those kind of decision makers, those key gatekeepers, get to determine what gets on stage, what gets on the page, what gets on screen, what gets on the radio. But at the same time, they're making judgments about what counts as kind of culturally good things. And those kind of hierarchies of what counts as good and what is marginalized map onto markets, they map onto funding systems. And they map onto kind of broader social inequalities as well. So it's not just a matter of like who gets to, you know, go to see a play or, you know, who's interested in a particular genre of film and, you know, who gets to work in, I don't know, Hollywood or in the British West End, but also the way that some groups in society have their culture kind of marginalized, ignored, denigrated, whilst others are held up as, you know, whether it's the kind of peak of Western civilization and, you know, the canon, or whether it's, you know, on a kind of smaller or more gentle level of just being the kind of culture that's seemingly sort of accessible to all because it's well-funded, well-supported. It's, you know, kind of insulated from financial concerns like, you know, market downturns. So I guess, you know, I mean, I've noticed with your work, obviously, you know, there's big concerns in Canada about how artists are going to make it, how artistic and cultural organizations are going to survive. And the same is here in the UK. But in the UK, the government has tried to intervene, and they've been very explicit about trying to support what they call the kind of crown jewels, which is that classic, right, terrible British obsession with the monarchy. So, you know, the National Theatre, the Royal Opera House, you know, some of the major galleries. And this is a really good example of that, you know, cultural hierarchy coming through in terms of what's likely to survive the pandemic and then what is going to struggle.
Yeah, this is sort of gets to the crux of why we really wanted to speak to you, aside from the great book, is that you did have some involvement in the government's final policy, if I'm not mistaken, about this 1.7 billion number that they've decided to grant to cultural institutions. But it sort of belies what you were saying a minute ago about the fact that you know, who defines culture and what culture is defined as is so strictly maintained, and the power over that is held so strongly by a certain sector of society, by richer people, by whiter people, etc. What do you think of the British government's decision to give $1.7 billion to institutions? Are you in favor of it, or do you think that that is a kind of, that they're missing the point?
Okay, so just like a minor sort of thing.
Yeah,
I can't take any credit or any blame for the government's decision.
That's a good news, bad news story there, Dave. It is.
I do a variety of kind of cultural policy related things, which have been actually mainly focused on inequality. So the last thing I did was a research submission to a bit of parliament that's trying to kind of scrutinize and to an extent, I guess, kind of lobby the government about the arts crisis. So this is the Select Committee for Digital Culture, Media and Sport. And they released a report recently kind of identifying the scale of the crisis. And I fed into that using basically stuff actually that's in the book about labor market statistics, about attendance and taste statistics as well. And to kind of come to your question, it's difficult in a way because governments don't really have that many policy levers. You know, it's quite hard to sort of give out money, which sounds like a crazy thing to say, because everybody loves, you know, money. And there's like, you know, we have a tax system and a pension system and stuff where, you know, in theory you could give out money to people quite straightforwardly. But in terms of kind of how the government goes about an investment package or, you know, a support package or a bailout, whatever you want to kind of do, it sort of makes sense in a way to use the existing infrastructure, which is obviously institutions. The trouble is institutions right across the board are in real trouble, and, you know, they have effectively a sort of, you know, set of existential questions facing them. And the worry that you know, sort of everybody actually across the sector has, is that institutions are going to absorb the money to make sure they stay open at the cost of getting rid of those employees that are, you know, maybe we might call them, you know, precarious or, you know, sort of employed in more peripheral positions. Unfortunately, they tend to either be kind of front of house staff, security staff who do the, you know, the running of the organization on a day-to-day, or they're, you know, kind of artistic and creative practitioners who are, you know, commissioned or, you know, work there for a season, you know, who aren't like senior management. So, I mean, just to give a couple of examples, the South Bank Centre, which is, you know, a sort of combined concert hall, art gallery, a big multi-art space right on the river in London, is talking about plans to massively cut its staff with, you know, a real sort of organisational transformation away from being a major artistic and cultural employer. Next door, you've got the National Theatre. They're also in the middle of getting rid of a lot of, you know, kind of on contract workers, which again raises questions about the sustainability and viability of the arts workforce. We also know that those kind of, you know, peripheral entry levels are ones that tend to, I guess, are people who are, you know, more vulnerable to these difficult employment conditions. And they, not entirely, but, you know, they tend to be ones where jobs where you'd see women, people of colour, those from working class origins. Although that's, you know, a reflection of how elite these cultural management jobs are, and just, you know, sort of how white, how partial, how middle class, and to an extent how male those senior arts management jobs are. So it's really difficult, I guess, because on the one hand, you know, you can sort of see why the government has chosen this route, and it's good that the government is putting money into the system. But at the same time, there's real questions about what's going to happen to artists. You know, the government has got a different kind of funding support scheme for freelancers and self-employed people, which is, you know, one of the key ways that artistic and cultural workers are employed and make a living. But actually loads and loads of those people have just fallen through the cracks of that system. And I don't know how it is over in Canada, but the British benefit system, the kind of social welfare system, is punitive. It's designed to basically like punish people for being unemployed. It's not designed to be supportive at all.
So Dave, what I'm hearing in, you were in the middle of an answer about the 1.7 billion that the British government has decided to give to the arts, to arts institutions. And you were talking about how a lot of people in the institutional side of art are losing their jobs, and how that's disproportionately affecting people of color, women, and people from lower class backgrounds. You can just continue on that thought for us a little bit about what you feel the 1.7 billion will do and where it falls short.
Yeah. Just a couple of things to think through, I guess. It's slightly too soon to tell, I guess, because the government are only just in the process of giving real, you know, kind of specific details about how they're going to allocate the money. I think it was, yeah, I think in total $1.5 billion, which sounds like an incredibly large amount of money, but it's got to cover like a lot of different sectors.
Yeah, I mean, it really, you know, really isn't if you think about the subsidies given to things like, you know, farming or the oil and gas industry. I mean, it's absolutely minute compared to those things.
But even just in terms of having to cover, you know, bits of theatre, bits of, because the Arts Council deals with like publishing industry, performing arts, visual arts, bits of the film industry, bits of, you know, kind of the television industry as well. So they've been kind of going through the process of talking about how things are going to be allocated. And as we record, it looks as if they are trying to put a framework forward of how organizations can apply. But also there's been some noises from the government that if you're like about to go out of business, contact the Arts Council and they'll like talk to you, you know, immediately sort of thing. So I think it is a bit sort of messy in terms of...
Yeah, I mean, that's a bit of a strange policy. It's a bit of a strange policy to have it, considering that everyone's about to go out of business, right? I mean, this is a extinction level event for cultural institutions.
Yeah, it's really difficult this because there's like a massive long list of things I want to be really critical of the government for, like loads and loads of things that a right-wing government has done that are absolutely appalling. But I'm like moderately sympathetic to them because they have, you know, quite low levels of capacity to do policy making. They're constrained by what they can get out of the Treasury, which is the finance ministry, which is the kind of big, important ministry in the British system. And, you know, they are sort of struggling to keep up with, as you say, this extinction level event. I guess the worry is, though, is like so much of both the rhetoric and the kind of immediate policy response has been all about institutions. And I think, as I sort of alluded to earlier, you can understand why that is, but it potentially means that, you know, the bulk of the workforce, which has a really high level of freelancers and self-employed people, you know, may just kind of slip through the cracks. And indeed, there was some data I was looking at earlier today that suggested that in terms of kind of like who is applying for jobs and where job vacancies are, you know, there are no job vacancies in the arts, and it's people in the arts who are like looking for job opportunities outside of the sector. And the thing is, we know 2008 is not an exact comparison. It's very different. The effects are really different, and what's driving the economic and social crisis is really different. But we know that when people left, for example, the film industry, particularly women, they just didn't come back.
Right. Right.
Do you know what the outcomes of the people who leave are? Because I always talk about this mass exodus of talent that's going to leave the arts. Do they go to lives that are financially better or worse? Do they have to rebuild themselves? Is there any data on that? Because I know a lot of our listeners are thinking about this and thinking about this new world that they might have to enter.
Yeah, I mean, like, I can only give you a really tedious academic answer that's full of.
That's
like,
why you're here, baby. That's why you're here.
Loads of caveats and stuff, but basically it really varies depending on how old people are, the kind of cultural career they're in, their gender, and I guess kind of what sort of qualifications they've got as well. And a lot of that variation is made kind of difficult to I guess kind of tease out because of the overlap between particular jobs. So for example, it's probably similar in Canada, but a lot of creative writing, poetry is deeply intertwined with the university system, with university teaching, because, like, you know, very few people make money from creative writing, from poetry, you know, that kind of stuff. And in some ways, in, you know, there are ways of doing this stuff in economic statistics, but it's difficult because the numbers that get picked up are quite small, and it's, you know, it's sort of hard to say if someone has got like a vocation of being a writer, but they're, you know, employed for like 3 days a week at a university. Well, are they an academic then, or are they a writer? You know, this kind of stuff. And there's been various sort of academic papers trying to tease this out. There was some good work done probably about a decade ago now, thinking about how that works for contemporary composers and for choreographers as well. And again, you know, teasing out the difference between them as academics in universities and then as creative practitioners is tricky. We know for women, two things happen. One is, depending on how old they are, they end up as, you know, primary caregivers, depending on what their partner does as well, what their partner's kind of primary job is. This really good work that's been done by people like Tamsin Dent at King's College in London and the University of Southampton as well, that sort of suggests that caregiving is really unevenly distributed. So even where a woman filmmaker has been like really, really successful, she's, you know, even then she's still likely to, you know, sort of be the one that kind of drops out and ends up being the primary caregiver compared to her husband or her male partner's career. So yeah, it really, really varies. It's really, you know, difficult to kind of find a typical career. But what we do know is that just people don't come back.
You've spent your life, or at least some of it, thinking about sort of what this has become. I mean, a lot of what you're writing and your thinking has been about is what the arts mean in society and how we sort of not only preserve them, but make them more relevant to everyone. And then this happens. Do you, as an academic, given all that you've written and all that you've studied and all of the stuff that you've taken in over the years, is there an opportunity here? Is there some kind of opening to actually implement some of the things that your book suggests are necessary for culture to remain relevant?
That's a really good question. And I guess it sort of depends what mood and what kind of day you catch me on.
Yes, man. Yes, so, man. We all feel that.
In some ways, what we're watching in the UK and, to an extent, what I think is going to take place in the States, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in Germany and France, where they've been quite sort of interventionist in terms of giving funding to their cultural sectors. But much as the kind of, I suppose, the maybe one part of the social discourse around the pandemic has been, we'd like to get back to normal. We'd like to get back to the world as it was before. There's going to be that kind of line of thought that runs through cultural policy. So, supporting institutions in some ways is a good example of how, trying to support things as they were before the pandemic to preserve, the good elements or the good parts of the cultural system is going to also completely preserve the inequalities that existed in that system. And sadly, my suspicion is there's going to be more of that than there will be more radical reform. That said, though, if ever there was a time where you could make, maybe you could make demands of institutions, where you could say, we know you've been very slow in terms of your hiring policies. We know, your board hasn't changed very much. And we know, your programming has reflected maybe a quite, narrow vision of what you think a particular audience is interested in or would like. Well, we're not going to give you financial support unless you've got, a radical set of ideas. And at least in England, the Arts Council at the very start of the pandemic did try and make noises about that. So there are a couple of statements from their, sort of senior policy officers around, we're interested in making sure organisations diversify their audiences and their workforces. We're still totally committed to that. The pandemic has changed, nothing in terms of that commitment. But then, in practice, things are sort of, in England and / the UK, this moment has not been a never let a good crisis go to waste moment. The moment has been a, we've got to do all we can to make sure parts of the system don't fail, which is totally legitimate, and I totally understand that. But in doing so, it essentially kind of preserves inequalities in the first instance. And because / maybe if, because this might change in the next month when there's a proper framework for how that money will be distributed, but what's likely to happen is preserving the system will actually reinforce and actually accelerate the inequalities, because the kind of people that are going to lose their jobs, the kind of people that are going to be first in terms of being let go, the kind of people who maybe are on the periphery of networks for commissions, the kind of people who, maybe have got a sort of decent track record, but, a sort of not top of the list for being, on a list of contacts, the sort of people who don't have familial or private means to kind of ride out the storm and have had to go and find employment in other sectors. Those kind of people are unlikely to be the ones who end up being supported. And we know, as I've said already, they're more likely to be particularly working class origin, people of colour, and in certain sectors, more likely to be women as well. So, yeah, it's unfortunate, really, that I think the pandemic is awful, and you know, we should be really sort of like wary of people being like, oh, this is an awesome opportunity, because that's just terrible, and you know, people are losing their lives and losing their jobs. But unfortunately, I think any, you know, possibility of something radical has maybe just not been on the table, which I guess is why I'm interested in the stuff you guys are doing, because obviously you are suggesting really radical things like a new deal for arts and for artists.
Right. You know, it's so funny. I was going to ask you about what, you know, you interview culture, people in culture in the UK in your book. And the first person you speak of is Henna. It's a pseudonym, but, you know, she's South Asian. She's from a middle-class background living in London. She's in film and TV, but she has like a prestigious degree from a great university. She has every possible advantage to like make it. But she speaks about how it's not a meritocracy for her, and there are so many things that are just preventing her from succeeding in the business. And I was going to ask you, I was going to say, after this shit sandwich, is it going to be easier for her or harder for her? But if I'm correct, I think you're suggesting it's going to be even harder for her, which is interesting because you think of all the political and societal change that's going on. Do you still think that it would be harder for someone like Henna after this is over?
Okay, so she is a really good example, and it's very much a pseudonym. Like part of being able to get these incredible, move-in and interesting life stories from people was, a really kind of clear agreement that they wouldn't be identified or identifiable in any way, and. Just thinking about her, that this is awful, and it's a kind of, you know, terrible sociological kind of cliche, but thinking about her as a, you know, almost a demographic category, as a middle-class origin, well-educated, wealthy woman of color working in the film industry. In some ways, she's experiencing a moment where she'll find a lot of support and a lot of interest in her work. So one of the things that's happened in response to Black Lives Matter, both globally, but also in the UK in particular, is that the television industry has made particular commitments to commissioning program makers of color to try and redress the balance in terms of underrepresentations. So from that moment, Henna, you know, might get some connections. You know, she might benefit from a raised profile and raised visibility, which, you know, would be a good thing, because one of the things she raises our awareness of is that despite having all of these, you know, kind of economic, social, and cultural resources, her gender and her skin color were real barriers to her being successful in the film industry. And like later on in the book, we kind of highlight women of color's experience across the arts, because they kept telling us, you know, I was the only person in the room. I'd get people interested, you know, because they were like, we could probably get a grant for working with, you know, you and your organization, but then they would.
We need
speak
a diverse
to me
person. Yeah, I know.
Exactly. Or you know, they'd be called the diversity as part of a project or something like this. So, in some ways, this moment will be, you know, a good moment. But at the same time, I think we're going to see a reduction of resources available. So even where, for example, the BBC has committed large amounts of money to supporting people of colour coming through as program makers as part of the television / film industry, you know, their budget is going to be reduced for a variety of reasons. You know, there are lower incomes they're getting and stuff like this. So the kind of competition for resources is likely to be won by those who are best placed to take advantage. And this is where understanding the kind of intersections of class, race, and gender are really, really important. So someone like Henna, who, you know, was kind of like well-connected, she might do okay, but it's likely that she'd also be frustrated because, you know, there'd be a feeling from her, and also an assumption from, you know, unfortunately, you know, some rather unreconstructed parts of the film and television industry that she was only being hired, you know, because of Black Lives Matter moment. And this is something that we found with arts institutions, actually, in particular, that what would happen would be working class origin women of color would, you know, go into the institution for a couple of years. They would get loads of connections. They would, you know, have their careers set up. They would have a really bad time. They would really not enjoy it. The institution would basically be pretty racist towards them. And then they'd leave and do a slightly different kind of job in the arts, something that was more precarious, was freelance, but, you know, didn't have the kind of institutional baggage. And my sort of assumption is that we'll get lots of that over the next few years with the Black Lives Matter moment, where, you know, there'll be lots of kind of 2-year careers, maybe, you know, 1 or 2, maybe 3-year moments. And then those individuals are likely to go back to being, you know, unless they're really in the middle of hiring networks, they're likely to go back to being on the periphery. So that's an incredibly long-winded answer, but I've not actually finished. So there's like a couple of other things to say. One is, it's important to recognize that, like, cultural labor markets are really awful for everybody. And the levels of competition, you know, that just the kind of the sheer demands to make it are so, you know, sort of like relentless and so ruthless that nobody has a good time, you know. And this unfortunately creates a kind of weird false sense of social solidarity that obscures, you know, some of the important barriers and some of the important inequalities. So the impact of the pandemic is going to be awful for everybody. And, you know, even people who are, like, you know, really well networked, who have got, you know, great careers, who are, you know, wealthy for a variety of reasons, will still struggle to get back in. An analogy comes from women who leave creative careers to start families. And even if they're, like, you know, really, really wealthy, really well connected, have all the kind of right kind of cultural connections, they still struggle to get back in because, you know, 9 months or a year or 6 months away from the kind of key networks that allow them to get work means that they just, you know, kind of drop off. Yeah, you know, it's going to be difficult for everybody. But I think it's going to be most difficult for those who don't have connections, who don't have wealth. And unfortunately, you know, those people are from working class backgrounds. They tend to be people of color, particularly from working class backgrounds. And in things like film and TV, they tend to be women. And yeah, the pandemic, the kind of burden of the pandemic is going to fall hardest on those groups.
Okay, so I want, you know, we're three dudes here, but I do, one of the things, and I've been hearing this now, this new refrain that I'm hearing about the importance, and it's in your book, of childcare for cultural workers, obviously for particularly women, to, you know, elevate them. What kind of possibilities do you see there? How much of a hindrance is not having access to proper childcare? Like, how much of a hindrance is it to women in the cultural sector?
So I think there's a bunch of things that came out from our interviews. And also actually we drew really heavily on a load of research that's been done in the UK. The UK is really, you know, focused on this question actually. So Tamsin Dent, Susan Berridge, these kind of people have highlighted this issue in particular. And I guess there's like a broad social thing of Britain isn't as bad as the US in terms of, you know, there is...
there's nothing over there, yeah.
Oh, it's terrifying. Like, it's terrifying. Crazy. But the British system is, you know, is not great. And in particular, whilst, you know, sort of maternity cover is complicated for freelancers and is kind of, you know, unequal, access to childcare when individuals are ready to go back to work, it is really difficult, and the government gives some support for that, but not, you know, kind of not nearly enough. And there's, I guess, the practical question of can you afford to go back to work? You know, particularly if you're in a low paid bit of the arts, there's the question of whether your workplace will support you. So, you know, some places that are more, you know, like institutions are good in terms of changing working patterns and hours. Other parts, unfortunately, you know, the kind of performing arts and film and TV tend to be the worst for this, where they're just like, look, the job is to work 80 hours a week. If you can't do that, we don't want you to work here. And we've got lots of those stories of, you know, women being told really bluntly that like, but this is the job, you know, and like, if you can't do it, you shouldn't be working here. So rather than, you know, reflecting on really like, you know, 80 or 100 hour weeks is the job, which is ridiculous. You know, that's a really kind of brutal working life for any individual, you know, irrespective of their kind of caring responsibilities. So, you know, there's that structural problem. And then there's, you know, the gender imbalances where, and this is, we put this at the end of one of our chapters, that men didn't raise kind of childcare or having children as an issue for their careers at all when we spoke to them. Whereas for women, particularly women in their late 20s and then women with children, you know, it was a big issue. For some men, we have quite a nice story from a woman who was working in the music industry where, you know, for her, the sense was that men with children in the music industry were hailed as heroes. You know, we're like, it's so brilliant that you've managed to raise kids and still work in the music industry. Whereas she was kind of told like, it's a bit odd you haven't had a child yet. You know, you're a bit kind of strange. And the assumptions, the kind of, you know, the basic sexist assumptions of, you know, what a woman's job is, what a woman's role is, you know, carries through into how cultural production works. And we see from long-term analysis of the census going back to the 1970s, you know, we can see that kind of late 20s into the early 30s, women drop out and they just don't come back from cultural jobs.
So, you know, right after the pandemic, everybody started to put their work online and they started to make their work free, $0. They were just giving it out. And there's a part in your book and you discuss the work that cultural workers do and how much of it is for free and the good and bad of that fact. I can't help but think, and I assume you're going to say yes, but I think that's just going to go forward, correct?
I mean, yeah, it's the short answer. I mean, there's so much to be said about this. And actually, again, you know, there's really interesting research that's coming out of the UK at the moment. So there's an academic called Karen Patel, who's just published this really good book about how cultural workers sort of like respond and use digital as part of their practice and, you know, as part of like their kind of brand and, you know, their labor. And it's, she makes it really clear in the book that it's, you know, again, patterned by inequalities. So, you know, it's not just a matter of like putting work out for free, but like, you know, you have to build the brand and, you know, you have to have a sort of a reputation already that people are interested in and stuff like that. And then there's some work from my colleagues at the Arts Humanities Research Council's Policy and Evidence Centre that was published today, actually, that looked at consumption of digital culture, or, you know, the digital mode of consumption of culture over the course of lockdown. And again, we see important inequalities of social class, of age, of gender in there as well. And leaving aside those kind of, you know, broad issues about the shift to digital, one of the things we try and do in the book is again echo this like false sense of social solidarity. So, you know, for some people working for free is as you say, like is a gift, you know, that they have the
it's a privilege. Yeah.
No, totally. Like, you know, they have like the autonomy, the privilege to be able to say, well, I'll do this, you know, to maybe like help someone out, or actually, you know, maybe because they're interested in like a particular creative idea. So, you know, a good example would be stuff like going to the Edinburgh Festival, which, you know, would be on at this time of the year. People lose like loads of money, and you know, they can see it as like an investment in maybe getting a radio show commissioned or getting getting an agent for the first time or whatever. Whereas for those people who don't have the kind of financial resources, they are all working for free as well. But working for free for them is basically doing like really, you know, kind of rubbish student films that they get promised pay in like headshots or show reels that never materialize. It's doing like profit shares that don't go anywhere. It's, you know, kind of being exploited essentially, as opposed to having autonomy and privilege. And what was dead interesting to us was that there seems to be this big difference between like older interviewees and younger interviewees. So our older interviewees were like, no, you should never work for free. You know, your work is valuable, that kind of stuff. And then when we talked to them, they'd be like, well, I volunteered or I chipped in or I helped out with a reading or something like that. And it reflects their experience of a completely different labor market in the 1980s into the early 1990s, but also a completely different welfare state as well in the UK. And then for our younger listeners, they were like, yeah, we all work free, all of us. And so initially we thought, oh, is this an age thing? And then when we sort of teased it out, it was like, hang on, you know, giving stuff away, working for free, the idea of no or low pay from an internship in publishing through to, yeah, you know, giving work away online. That was all reflective of sadly, actually reflective of people's kind of class origins and their class privileges.
So Dave, we'll let you go because I hope you can hear me right now. Can you hear me?
I can. Yeah.
Oh, hooray. How wonderful. You've been amazingly generous. I'm going to put you on the spot for our final question, which is, you are the culture czar for Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Imagine such a thing.
That would be so bad.
Wouldn't it be bad? No, I think it'd probably be better than it is now, mate. But what would you do? I mean, it feels like, as you say, you end up having sympathy even for a political party whose most famous leader said that there's no such thing as society. What would you do right now to save artists and art? What could be done?
Yeah, I think at this moment, it's so difficult. And with all elements of public policy, you know, to govern is to choose. So there are trade-offs and there are things that aren't perfect. And I think right now, I'd think about a massive expansion of the welfare system, which, you know, would be a blunt instrument, would, you know, capture lots and lots of people who, you know, maybe to an extent didn't quite need it or, you know, possibly could have, you know, survived. But actually that, you know, a kind of fair and just welfare system that wasn't punishing people. So, you know, that's in terms of providing support for housing costs, providing support for income. I wouldn't go as far as a universal basic income because I think there are massive problems with that in the British context. But for now, for this moment, you know, helping people to survive and kind of live good and decent lives as we get past the pandemic moment. And in theory, you know, with a vaccine, are allowed to start, you know, going to theatres, going to cinemas, are allowed to start going to concerts. Creators are allowed to start creating again. That would be like my big kind of idea. At the same time, that wouldn't help institutions. You know, institutions in that context would probably fold. They'd certainly lay off lots of staff. And there is a question about, well, what would individual creatives come back to? So at the same time, I think, you know, my sort of welfare czar, I'd be petitioning whoever he, she or they was to kind of get onto that. But I'd also be thinking about how can we make sure that institutions get sort of supported for long enough so they don't fail, but also at the same time attaching strings to that money so they have to deliver on changes towards being you know, more representative, more reflective, more diverse, particularly actually in places like London and Birmingham and Manchester in the UK, which, you know, are the UK's, you know, major cities. And often there are big questions about whether their arts institutions reflect them. So yeah, I mean, the thing you said right at the start, like I really don't envy the people making these decisions, because these decisions are really difficult, and you know, the impact on society and economy is really awful.
Wow. Dr. Dave O'Brien, thank you so much. Before you go, is there like a, you know, you're an artsy guy. Is there any art that's kind of getting you through this time right now, recently? Have you come across something?
Honestly, it's best we don't discuss my appalling tastes in any kind of like public forum. Okay. Like Disney Plus launching in the UK the same week as lockdown has been a great help.
Okay. Yeah, it's crazy. I didn't know that. You guys were delayed. You guys were delayed for a while with Disney Plus, but you know, it came right at the, did you see Hamilton? Did you like that?
So I've not actually watched Hamilton yet, despite all of my friends pleading with me to watch it. I spent most of my time like rewatching the Avengers films in order. Obviously all of the Star Wars, a lot of the, I thought the Mandalorian was brilliant. That kind of stuff.
Oh, it was wonderful. Yes.
I, you know, I'm really lucky. I've got like a full-time job that's in theory very secure, but you know, it's difficult to like write about a crisis in culture all day and then, you know, sort of
watch the National Theatre Live or something. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I the National Theatre Live has been really good. James Graham's This House, I thought was fantastic. I'd seen that twice, in the West End already. And it was great to watch that, but equally, it was really, you know, kind of poignant, because there was a sense of, when will I be able to go back to these institutions? And it's been the same
bittersweet.
You know, again, these are my terrible, terrible cultural tastes, but Metallica have been doing Metallica Mondays. So I've been watching some of their concerts, like streamed, one of which I was at in Manchester last year. But again, it's bittersweet, because it's like, these were the things that structured my cultural life. And when will I be able to do them again? So yeah, it's tricky.
Wow. Right. Metallica Mandalorian. There it is. Dr. Dave O'Brien, thank you, sir.
Hey, no worries. Cheers. Thanks very much.
All right, cheers. Yeah.
Bye.
Dave O'Brien on Soft Revolution, talking about the future of art, not just in the UK, but everywhere. But yeah, I mean, it goes back to our earlier conversation, Ali. I don't think anybody really knows. There is no silver bullet for the arts, that's for sure. But it sure would be nice if people would start talking about it, other than artists. It sure would be nice if somebody in the world of public policy started to pay a little more attention to what potentially a lack of art for 2 to 3 years in the world will do to our economy, our psychology, and the future for our kids. I'm kind of sick of politicians ignoring it. I really, really am. Speaking of which, have you signed the petition on change.org started by Ali Moman?
Well, we got a website
now,
bro.
For the arts. Yes,
we got a website.
Talk about it.
Makeartswork.ca. Actually, Ravi Jain gave me that idea, because he was like, you know, you got to make arts work because art works. And I'm like, yeah, man, that's what I'm talking about. So makeartswork.ca. You go, it has all the details, it has a bunch of articles, a bunch of literature, but it's got this button that's all around the website called Act Now. You hit the button and it takes you to the petition. And also, yeah, it has a pre-written email to our heritage minister. Listen, a lot of people outside Canada are like, should I do this? Yeah, fuck it. He doesn't know. He doesn't know. Email him. This guy has gotten hundreds of emails, so hopefully he'll listen.
Yeah. Do it. And go visit us at Soft Revcast on Instagram, Soft Revcast.
Join our Patreon,
people. We are now on Patreon, Soft Revolution Podcast on Patreon. You're going to get extra bonus episodes every month. You're going to get early access to every episode each week. You're going to get any and all media appearances that media maven Ali Moman is making these days to argue for an Arts New Deal. It's worth the money and we need the support. So please visit our Patreon page if you have a few bucks to spare and join us there for even more of Soft Revolution. Ali, what's your art pick this week, my man?
Listen, it's so popular, but I don't care. Beyonce's Black is King. That's on Disney Plus. I mean, whatever's going on in the world, that kind of celebration of of women, that celebration of blackness. God, love it. I love it. And what's also really nice about it is that this is basically a movie of an album that came out last year, which was the soundtrack to the Lion King remake. But it was very much not music from the show at all. It was like a kind of like an Afrobeats meets Beyonce kind of album. And it's fantastic. Has some of the best African artists. And this, I really hope, is a way for people to go and you know, re-listen to that album because it's fantastic. But it's so beautiful. Good job, Beyonce.
I haven't checked it out yet, but I love her. And beautiful. Of course I will. I'm also going to choose some music this week. And I'm also going to choose a black woman, but it's an old tune. It's called Talking About a Revolution by Tracy Chapman. I've been listening to that record a lot. It's like it was written yesterday. It's crazy how current all the things that she addresses on that album are. So if you haven't listened to the debut album by Tracy Chapman in a long, long time, go back, man, because first of all, it's just a perfect record from start to finish. But it also, I really feel like, speaks to what's happening right now. And, you know, when Tracy Chapman came out as a star in 1988, I think it was, you know, here was a 24-year-old black lesbian folk singer who sold like 10 million albums and got to number one with a song about, you know, poor people leaving town to move to the suburbs. Like, incredibly ahead of its time and incredibly powerful. And it's just been really hitting me in the feels, as the kids say these days. So that's my pick this week. So we'll go out on some, what, on Tracy? We're going to go out on Tracy? Talk about a revolution. We're talking about a revolution. It's a soft one and it hasn't happened yet, but we're going to hang in there until it does. Thank you so much for joining us again this week. I'm glad to be back. Thanks for holding the fort, Allie. Yeah, I appreciate it, buddy. For sure. We'll see you next week with more talk, more hope, and more fighting spirit on Soft Revolution. Take care of yourself. Wear a mask. Write something. Make something creative. We love you.
Love you, man.
Love you, buddy. Bye. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment line, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Who are people gonna rise up and take what's theirs? Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution, ooh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying to those observers, armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Oh, no, talking about a revolution. Oh, no, talking about a revolution.